Kia ora, Aotearoa, and welcome to Generally Famous. I'm Simon Bridges, and every week I talk to generally famous but always interesting guests about life, love, and what makes them tick. Today's guest is a renowned New Zealand cricketer, one of the greatest batsmen in the world, many records and bests, most runs, centuries, catches, and the first to play 450 internationals and 100 in each of the three formats of Test, One Day, and 2020. Ross Taylor, welcome to Generally Famous.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, don't be modest. You still hold, it hasn't been that long since you've been out of cricket, but you still hold lots of world records and a whole lot of New Zealand ones. Which are you most proud of?
Good question. I've never been asked that.
I'll tick that up as a win already.
Yeah, probably one that you mentioned. I mean, 450 games. I think I would have been happy to have played a couple of games for New Zealand.
Yep.
290 at Perth would have to be up there. I've just recently come back from Australia, and I don't know whether it's because I've retired or, a lot of them would come up and said, you know, loved the way you batted, how you went about your career, and 290 at Perth was fantastic. Where when I played in Australia, I never had any of that stuff. So I'm presuming it's only because I've retired that they feel comfortable enough to come and tell that. And,
yeah.
And obviously being a Kiwi as well.
Yeah, it's often the way once you go, they say, oh, that was great, this was great. And it's like, why didn't you tell me at the time?
Would have felt better.
Yeah, exactly.
But no, it's been pretty cool.
What have you been up to recently, actually? I know you've not so long ago you're in India and you're just saying you're in Aussie. What's life post actually being in the Black Caps sort of like?
Yeah, so I retired in April. The last few months of my career, obviously trying to work out when the best time to retire was, and I was doing the book at that time. So no, it's been an interesting process. Was in India for five weeks. My first cricket since retiring.
Yeah.
Playing against likes of Sachin Tendulkar, Brian Lara, and coach Jonty Rhodes, some of these players who I never played against, but obviously a few of your older listeners will understand some of the greats of our game. And then just recently came back in the weekend in an ICC capacity. I was an ambassador for ICC at the 2020 World Cup. A little bit strange to catch up with the boys. I gave Kane Williamson his Man of the Match trophy the other day, which was a little bit different. But no, it's been nice to still be part and I suppose involved in cricket in some capacity.
And are the likes of Tendulkar and co, are they still got it?
Oh, Tendulkar, I don't want to throw Shane Bond under the bus, but Shane Bond bowled him a couple of short bounces and Sachin played it like he hadn't retired. He was
right.
There was probably 35,000 people there screaming his name. We'd like to say they came to watch us, but they only came really to watch Sachin. he's still, but like all those players, I'm sure they don't lose it. You probably lose your eyes and your fitness a little bit, but your hand-eye coordination, you never lose.
Still there, yeah, absolutely. Hey, I want to start at the beginning. You grew up in Masterton and Palmy. Are you okay?
I've turned out all right, haven't I? And then now I live in Hamilton. I mean, Palms North and Hamilton, two of the most hassled places.
Do you not like the water?
No, I've grown to love this, but no, I actually really enjoyed growing up in Masterton. You, I don't know, any time you played sport, you're always the underdogs, going the big smoke, going to Wellington, Napier, even Whanganui. That was always the big smoke compared to Masterton. So I don't know whether that probably did help me out at various times during my career in some capacity.
I just want to say I've got a brother who's a primary school principal in Masterton, okay, and lives at Lansdowne.
Lansdowne?
Not just close to that golf course. So it's not, you know, I better be a bit careful here, right? It's all right.
100%. Christmas could be a bit strange.
Yeah, exactly. Why cricket? Why when you were young, and I know you would have done a raft of other things, but what do you think in the end it was that it was cricket you took seriously?
I'm not sure. My dad played cricket.
Yeah.
I love watching him play, following him around. My sisters were into sport, but they weren't that into cricket, and played hockey in the winter. Our principal at Cornwall Street School was a big hockey and tennis man, but cricket was probably my first love. And watching the 1992 World Cup, probably made me want to play for the Black Caps. But no, I mean, I dreamt to play for the Black Caps, but I never really thought it was possible. But I suppose as you get through the grades and there was a bit of a career path.
You say that though, but like reading your book and you know what I know about you, you're unassuming about it all, but you know, you took it deadly serious is my sense of it, right? You really, it's not as if this kind of just you lucked into it. You were deeply dedicated to the sport of cricket.
Oh, very much so. I came across as probably relaxed, but you know, I love the game of cricket and pretty intense in the way I prepare and go about it. You know, we had a tree at home where we would hit a hockey sock with a hockey ball in it, and I used to just hit balls for hours. So as a 10, 11-year-old, you're hitting balls for 3 or 4 hours a day. You're teaching yourself a work ethic. And I didn't know that I was doing that. I was just trying to have fun and learning it. But, you know, you're hitting balls for that long, you're probably going to be quite good at it. It's like anyone, you train hard, you're going to be good for it. But did I know I was doing that at the time? No, not at all. But looking back on it, you know, that definitely helped me and grooved my game. It probably got me into some bad habits at times. But what they say, 10,000 hours. Well, I must have been.
Yeah,
I must have been right up there in terms of you know. By the time I played international cricket, it would have been a lot of training before then.
And you mentioned 92 and World Cup. I mean, back then, who were the legends that you looked up to?
This is funny how cricket or life works out. Martin Crowe and Mark Graybatch had fantastic World Cups, and they became very key individuals at different stages of my career. But they weren't my favourite players. I guess Batchy came and smacked it, but he was a left-hander. Mark Waugh and Sachin Tendulkar were my two favourites growing up. I suppose they were a bit younger. You could relate to them a little bit. I couldn't tell you how old Sachin was. Probably still a teenager when he played in that tournament. I never came across Mark Waugh, but it was always a little bit surreal when you played Sachin, being a you know, having someone that you admired and grew up not necessarily emulating, but the way he went about things and cricket, to then play against him for New Zealand. He is a god in India. As we were talking before,
just like you, he'd need several security guards, wouldn't he?
he would need a few more than a couple. I would have thought.
Yeah, totally.
No, he wouldn't. You know, it's nice to be able to walk around New Zealand, and
he couldn't do anything.
I think that's why they enjoyed coming to New Zealand, the Indian team.
Yes,
the anonymity, walking back from the grounds. I mean, Hamilton. I can remember driving home, and you'd see, you know, Sehwag and a few of these guys that would never be able to do that and probably never experience that. Where, you know, coming to little old New Zealand, being able to do just the little things which they wouldn't be able to do back home.
Did you get close to, I mean, in your cricket career, you get close to any of those, you know, big names in cricket internationally?
I suppose your IPL, you would have played with a lot of them. Rahul Dravid, I played with him for 4 years.
Yep.
Nicest guy in world cricket as far as I'm concerned. True gentleman. Once again, he was very unassuming, but I just love picking his brains. A great thinker of the game of cricket. And, yeah, you're young, you're impressionable, and it's nice to, you know, catch up with these people, you know, when you see them around the traps towards the end of your career and even to this day.
You talk in the book about, you know, Shane Warne and, you know, Brightly Burning Light. I mean, what was he like as a character?
I got him towards the end of his career, but a fantastic individual. One of the only people I've watched in the change room where I just watched his every move, you know, just the way he went about it. And it probably helped that Liz Hurley was with him at the time as well. So Liz was, I can remember Liz as Austin Powers when I was in high school. So to have Liz just walking around and seeing her at breakfast.
I hope she wasn't with him when he was getting changed in the changing rooms with you.
Oh, no, she wasn't there. Definitely not. But no, Warnie was, once again, a great thinker of the game, a great storyteller. My first game, we won in Hyderabad. And Rahul Dravid, Shane Warne, and a few other international players. And we're in the front row. And he had us on the edge of our seats for an hour and a half flight, just telling story after story, the way he delivered it. You know, I think I said in the book, I'd love to be able to share some of the stories, but they're probably not appropriate for the book. But I mean,
you get cancelled, mate. Don't do it.
But he's had a phenomenal life, obviously taking far too early, But he did pack a lot in his 51, 52 years.
We've already actually talked a lot of highlights, right? It's amazing things and amazing career you've had. If we talk lowlights, I mean, the obvious one that's there in the book, throughout is, and it's my sense is that not so much that you weren't, there was a point in time when you were no longer captain. It was more kind of how it was taken from you. I mean, is that fair?
No, I think it's a fair, at the end of the day, professional sport's pretty ruthless. But at the end of the day, you're still human and you have emotions and being treated with respect. I didn't think I was at that stage. There's a lot of underhand dealings going behind the scenes that probably was evident to people around the group, but not evident to the public.
Yep.
And this wasn't to settle scores or anything. This was to tell my side of the story that hadn't been able to be shared. I think, different people you talk to afterwards, knew that things were going on behind the scenes, but it was a lot worse than they probably thought.
There's a great quote in your book from Hogan, from Martin Crowe, your mentor. He talks about the depths of despair you'd endure around this and, the trust that had never been a problem for you, right? I mean,
You take people at face value.
Exactly. But, in a flash that was gone and there was such a, in his words, quote, the rotten odour that permeated his gunning down. I mean, if I look at it from the outside and read your book, and there's bits I absolutely identify with, nothing's ever simple, right? And I'm not suggesting, because I don't know that you go quite this far to say we're talking outright racism or anything, but, you're a young Samoan man. And what's also true is you're sitting there and you don't come from a wealthy family, far from it, right? You've got a dad in a factory, mum cleaning, they're sacrificing for you to kind of do what you're doing. And some of this is subtle, right? Like you speak in the book about how, if something goes missing in the changing room, they're looking around for you potentially. Or, maybe it's when you are captain, you, for whatever reason, don't sort of have the bravado and the team talk sort of stuff that some of the other senior players might have. I mean, is that – how do you see it?
Yeah, I mean, that incident I talk about in the book wasn't in the Black Caps. That was as a youngster in a hockey team. But I mean, I think there's elements of my career that my upbringing and the humbleness that my family, how I grew up and the respect that my grandparents and all my aunties and uncles, put on us, helped me out of my career. But then there's also different stages in leadership role. As a captain, talking to senior players, the cultural barriers where, as an Islander, you're always told to respect your elders, and here you are as a captain at 25, 26, 27, vice captain, telling guys you grew up admiring and having a lot of respect for. And that definitely, the cultural barrier definitely didn't help me out in that regard. But you learn. You can't go through life thinking, oh, blah, 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 or, all these different things. That's what happened. I would have done things differently, 100%. But that's where I was at that point in time. And, if I was older and a bit more mature and a bit more resilient after this incident, I probably would have been a better captain and a better leader in the team.
And there's some bright lights, right? And I want to come to it because I think actually what you say is the fact that in a sense you were, in your words, possibly too soon into captaincy, but then out the other end, meant you had a long career, some amazing stats, and we'll sort of come to that. But, if we just dwell on it for 1 second longer, what comes through, and I said to you off air, and it's absolutely what I think, I didn't realise there was so much bloody politics in cricket, right? And there's a point there where it's kind of everyone from team to coaches to managements, either in your camp or Brendan's camp, right? But what comes through to me clearly is the sense, whereas he's, able to drink and talk beer, racing, golf, that's kind of not your gig. Again, is that sort of fair?
In terms of politics, I think you'd be naive to not think that it goes on. And I think people would be naive not to think that it doesn't go on in other sport, professional sports in New Zealand as well. But then, professional sport, cricket, politics, office job down the road, I think. And they all have different degrees of manoeuvring politic in whatever way you want to call it. It's just that, you know, you've been a member of parliament, myself being in a professional team, and the spotlight been on you a little bit more than the office job. It was a tough time. You know, as I said, you're always told to respect people, but at the same time, you're always sort of told to stick up for yourself at different times. And sometimes it didn't come easy, but you just had to do what you had to do.
Just two final things on the captaincy, and then we'll, believe you me, there's plenty more to cover over that. That's more positive than this. But, you know, when you think about it now, what does it mean to you? That whole, if my word, not yours, but that saga, if you like.
Yeah, I suppose it's something that I didn't want it to define my career, and people still talk about it when people come and ask me now about the book. But yeah, I still find it strange that, you know, it happened. Yeah, I don't know. Not that you think that you want an apology or anything, but, you know, if this happened to other athletes or that in different times, people would have, maybe, you know, put their hand up and said, yeah, we didn't do this as well as we would have liked, but we apologise. But there's been none of that, and nothing really since as well.
And in fact, Kim Littlejohn said in your book, which I thought was interesting actually, if what had happened to you happened to Brendan, the players' association would have gone at it. But for you, they sit there and they're quiet. That's the sort of thing you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're talking 10, 11 years now. But then, you know, different people have talked about the subject and said, oh, we wouldn't do anything differently. I think that speaks volumes about the whether the decision was right or wrong. You know, obviously the ends justifies the means in their eyes.
Do you think it's changed? You think things in cricket have changed?
No, I don't. I think there's still a lot of politics that go on. You just don't see it outwardly, I don't think. A lot of it's internal.
Yes. And as you say, that'll always be there. But I suppose, and I said I'd only need to ask you two more, I've asked you before, but, you know, do you think it should have changed? Are there things you would say should be different now?
Yeah, I think it's like anything. It's not until people actually leave the team and have a comfortable to talk about it or not talk about it at all. As a player that's been in a lot of different teams, I think it's improved a little bit. 100%. But I still think we've got a way to go.
The last question I was going to ask you about three questions ago was, you've got your book out. It's a great book. I've read it. The title's Black and White, and it's obviously with Paul Thomas. And as the title suggests, race is there. You know, racism at a level, my words, not yours, but that class thing I think is there as well. How's the reaction to that been in terms of, I'm thinking about people who know you and, you know, your former colleagues in the Black Caps and so on. Were they good on you? Fantastic that you've sort of talked about some of these, or was it kind of like, not sure about that? You've broken a bit of a code here by talking about what happens in the locker room.
Yeah, I hadn't really talked to many teammates, to be fair, that have read the book.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, we came up with the title were black and it was my story in black and white, and we just settled for black and white. I think obviously coming from a mixed race family, playing for New Zealand and wearing black and white as colours, I'm going to be black and white in the fact that in the way I tell my story, I've got to try and not say anything just because it's either going to upset somebody or to try and provoke a discussion. It was just my take on things, and I guess that's what an autobiography is there, to tell the truth and I guess make the reader make their own mind up.
Do you think it was good for you writing it? I'm not talking about the dollars. You'd earn more than that from about 5 minutes in T20, wouldn't you? But, you know.
Yeah, you would.
In terms of you personally.
Yeah, you don't write a book to make money. But it was, I think it was very therapeutic. It helped me at the time. We met with the publishers in 2013, and I got it off my chest. I think Gilbert Anoka, the All Blacks mental skills coach who I was dealing with at the time, said, Ross, just remember this. This will be a good book. It wasn't until then that I thought about writing a book, but I always knew that this day would come and that I could tell my side of the story, because that was, it wasn't easy in that change room, but that was my way of being able
Yes.
to deal with it, knowing that apart from Martin Guptill and maybe a couple others and passing comments, no one really knew what was going on at that time. And I'm
Yep.
sure if they did, they probably would have understood me a bit better.
Everything that's worth talking about, find and follow Newsable wherever you get your podcasts. Everything that's worth talking about, find and follow Newsable wherever you get your podcasts. For news and sport that's worth talking about, find and follow Newsable wherever you get your podcasts. Newsable Sport is proudly brought to you by Sky, your sport unrivaled. Were your shoes tied tight enough? I believe you told the crowd that was one of your main concerns, because you didn't want your shoes flying off mid-set. Do you kick a lot?
I don't not kick, but, I feel like it's just kind of a classic kind of nightmare thing where something happens that you could not have anticipated, and it's... I have a lot of scary gig dreams where I'm like shot of gig and I'm like, oh no, I forgot everything. I didn't bring my guitar or my pedals or my shoes, I guess.
I'm glad they were tied on tight enough. For everything that's worth talking about, find and follow Newsable wherever you get your podcasts. Newsable Entertainment, proudly brought to you by FX's Shogun, streaming now on Disney+.
Thinking bigger picture around cricket today, right? You Samoan through your mother, a trailblazer in that regard, and Kiwi cricket. Well, any cricket, right? Do you feel like today? I suppose very superficially, some people would say, well, cricket is a white person sport, right? Do you feel today that that's no longer the case? You're proud of your achievement in that regard?
I think you also got to put Murphy Saw. He was the first Samoan Polynesian to play for the Black Caps. And yes, I'm proud of what I've achieved and proud to fly the Polynesian flag. But there was also elements where I just felt like I was a Kiwi. Like, there was no, I'm out here to prove that Polynesians can play cricket. Not at all. I'm a Kiwi through and through, and just wanted to be the best player I could represent and hopefully win games of cricket for my country. There's a few island boys, Māori, Pacific Island lads that are playing domestic cricket. I hope there's more in time. But, if you look at the team now and who likes and watch cricket as a religion, there's a lot of Indian players in our team at the moment.
Yes.
It's only going to get more of them. You see the kids going around. And
has that changed the culture of cricket?
I think so. And I think for the better. I think culturally, we've got a lot of South Africans, a lot of Zimbabwean, their culture's coming into a cricket. Neil Wagner, BJ Watling, a lot of these guys, it's only positive. And then Ajaz Patel, who's Muslim. So, with alcohol and things like that, you're winning a game and you're spraying champagne, you just got to just step back a touch and all those little things. And I think, the team have evolved, organically over the last decade or so. And, I'm sure in the years to come, there's going to be a lot more, Indian, Sri Lankan, Bangladesh with the immigration that's happened over the last few years.
Your lovely wife's also, a serious cricketer. And I just raise this because it's very topical at the moment as we talk, women's sport, women's rugby World Cup and so on. How do you sort of look at all of that? Is cricket come a long way when it comes to women as well, or not as far as rugby, for example? What would you say?
The women are just on equal pay, a domestic match fee appearances, which I think is a massive step, and I'm sure my wife would have enjoyed that if that was around. But we have this discussion a lot. Obviously, we have kids, and we have a young daughter who loves sport, who loves everything. So, no, I think we can only say it as a positive. I think there's probably still a little way to go, but I think we're going in the right direction. The women's rugby, they've been awesome. But I think quite often in this regard, it's actually having it on TV and seeing it being accessible. If it's not on TV, how are you supposed to inspire the next generation? I'm sure there is still an element of it, but to see it on TV actually, I'm sure enhances it and makes it a little bit easier.
Yep. I already mentioned this, but my sense of reading your book, a lot of silver linings for you actually in getting out of the blasted captaincy stuff and being able to actually just focus on the game, right? Ian Smith says that you are the most stats obsessed guy he's known of since Hadley. Fair?
Stats, 100% true. It was a driver, but I hope it doesn't come across like it was in the benefit of the team. I guess when you're in the game. The game dictates how you play, but you travel so long. Some of these tours are long, and cricket's a tough game. You chose a profession where you fail, 60-65% of the time, but you're still world class. That's how you deal with failure, and sometimes you just need a bit of a reboot, and that's where your goals sort of came into it. Just gave you a different focus. But then it's like anything. When cricket was going well, you didn't need to worry about any of that stuff. You just kept going. When things weren't going quite well, those stats and those goals become an important driver.
You're good at them all, but was there a format out of Test one day 2020 you kind of preferred? I saw something from Dion Nash recently, you know, taking us back a little, but he of course, he said something like, you know, tests where it's at, T20 is like bad fast food, right? What do you say?
Yeah, I think test was still the ultimate. You know, there's so many variables, and you can, I guess, it's been around for over 100 years. You can compare yourself to the greats of the game. And one day cricket was probably my best format.
Yep.
In terms, but I love playing it. Where 2020, sort of, my timing of my career was very lucky in the fact that just as 2020 was starting, was the start of my career, and you had to learn, you know, a lot along the way. Where, you know, I think a lot of these kids that are growing up now who are coming into the New Zealand setup or any team around the world, they've grown up playing 2020 cricket from a young age. So, you know, they're playing all these amazing shots where we had to learn that. They're probably going to have to learn how to play test cricket the other way around. Yes. from probably people at my age.
We've talked about the mind games off the oval, but of course, it seems to me cricket is the ultimate mind game, right? And there's just so much of that. You got, it seems to me, a lot of help from a sports psychologist and so on. What did they provide to you? What was going on that meant that they helped you achieve more?
I think they reinforced that the feelings that I was having were normal. You know, when you're in the bubble of a team, you're 22, 23 years old, and you're getting articles written about you, good and bad. And that's not natural, I don't think.
No.
You know, to be critiqued, to do something that you love, but then now, yeah, it's open slather. At the start of my career, social media wasn't around as much where, yep. You know, once Twitter and Instagram and comments on the Herald and stuff, you could try and get away from it, but your family or your friends would tell you in some...
They think they're helping, but they're
they
not.
They think they're helping, but they're, but they're not.
Yeah.
But no, you're going through form slumps and just trying to grow up in the public eye and dealing with that. And the sports psychologists don't have the emotional attachment of the game. They're neutral. Some of them travel with us. Some of them, you're ringing them up at all hours of the night to try and get the time difference right. And yeah, just offload. Sometimes they wouldn't even do any talking. You do all the talking, but
yep.
They were fantastic. And not only sports psychologists, your teammates, your mentors,
your manager,
all those things. And sometimes it helped. Sometimes I would have done things differently, but as I said, Mike Sandel, a problem shared is a problem half. I think that's probably a no truer saying in the, from a sports psychologist point of view.
Yeah, absolutely. From Palmy Boys, it seems to me you were travelling. It's lifestyles of the rich and famous, mate. You were travelling everywhere. You were partying with Shaggy in Jamaica. Where would be the place in the world, not New Zealand, that you've gone to that you love the most? Or that if you could, in a heartbeat, be back there, you'd go back?
Yeah, good question. Two of the best things I've done was go walk in the grid at Formula One. I wish I took that in a bit more.
Where was
very
that?
Naive. It was in Abu Dhabi. So our owner of our Royal Challengers Bangalore team owned Force India, and I asked him for some tickets, and he said, no problem. But our trainer was Central Districts at the time, James Amon. I was telling him about it. He goes, his dad was Chris Amon, the Formula One driver. He said that was the most prestigious thing he could have done, Ross. And I wish I'd taken it in a bit more,
right.
But still a fantastic event. My favourite place to tour was England. I think the history of the place, it's probably a little thing, but just being able to bus everywhere. Yes. You don't have to pack, well, you still have to pack your bags, but you pack your bags, jump on the bus. You stop at a servo. You don't have to get to another airport, check in and fly 2 hours. You just jump on the bus and you can watch Sky, and there's PlayStations for the guys who want to do that. You can play cards, you can sleep. The little things that make it pretty cool.
Yeah, people can be a bit mean on poor old England, but actually it's a beautiful country, I think. And I'm married to a Brit, so I have to say that, but I believe it. What about place you'll never go back to? Be honest. You sit there and say, that's the most godforsaken part of the world. I've set that up too badly, and now you don't want to say anywhere. But
yeah, now I'm scared. won't be getting a posting there. Well, I think one of the toughest places to travel was 2007 World Cup was in Guyana. That was a tough place. And our coach at the time, John Bracewell, said at the hotel we stayed at, those are the same sheets and bedspread that when he was there in 1984. So it was
just a little more crusty.
But then they've discovered oil and went over there probably 5 or 6 years ago now. I actually played for Guyana as well, and the place had changed. The hotel is one of the nicest hotels I've ever stayed at. But in 2007, it was definitely an eye-opener.
Some of the things that amuse me and I've seen around you is, you know, you've done it all, mate. You've had sensitive operations and procedures in Zimbabwe. That didn't sound like a whole lot of fun. And I love the story of you and your lovely wife, the Taj Mahal. You make it onto the front page of the Times of India, and you're sitting there in that iconic sort of picture like Diana and Charles or whoever it was, except it wasn't your wife.
Yeah, wife Ross with wife Leanne. So my manager, Leanne McGoldrick, since I was probably 18 years old. My wife was umming and ahhing whether she should come over. And we've always wanted to go to Taj Mahal. And then we decided not to. Stay behind. And a few of the players in our team wanted to go to Taj Mahal. We're playing for Delhi. Our owner at the time owned the Delhi airport and had quite a few private jets. So the Learjet could only fit 9 people on there. There was 11 of us that wanted to go. So they put 2 jets on for us. And yeah, my manager, Leanne McGoldrick, wanted to sit on the Diana and do the Diana pose. And didn't know what she was going on about. I'm not going to lie. I do now since probably being a little bit more worldly. And Times of India. Yeah, that didn't go down too well, but I do have to rub it in, and I'm probably a poor husband, but every time there's an ad on that shows Taj Mahal, it's a great opportunity to just wind the wife up just that.
Have you been there with her now? No, not as an
ad. No, she's held me to it that I have to take all 3 of the kids and her back again. So obviously COVID and things are opening it back up, but it is a pretty amazing place, and I'm sure in the years to come I'll be able to fit it in and take the kids there.
As a Samoan boy now, man, you know, look, one other thing comes through very clearly to me is, and there's nothing wrong with this, a passion for food. As I say, from stealing it from Ian Smith, well, not stealing it, that's going a bit far, because Ian was, you were flatting, were you boarding with them or something, right?
Yeah, so Ian Smith's son, Jared, we played cricket together, and he was the only person I knew before I went to boarding school. So we got on really well, and obviously playing cricket. Jared went on to play football for New Zealand. He played for the All Whites. But yeah, growing up, you know, quite often at boarding school, the food wouldn't be that great. So we used to go down and get a $2 fried rice or just to try and top up our meal. And Ian was commentating in the Ashes. In the UK, so he started to wonder why, you know, Jared was spending a lot more on down at the local dairy than he had been in the past. But he just put that on me, really. You know, not the fact that his son was having a big appetite, but there's a bit of fun and games about that right to this day.
You're still a healthy eater?
Oh, my wife's on me, right. So I guess you have to. The kids are getting a bit better, but they're pretty fussy. And I guess growing up with not a lot of food and mum and grandma telling you to eat everything that's on your plate, I find it hard to chuck the food out that's left on the kids. So I will nibble away at it. But I've been fortunate enough to be able to travel the world and experience a lot of different cuisines.
A couple of things I wanted to ask you about, and then we're going to get into some quick fire. Look, one of the things that is amazed to me, and you know, I sort of knew, but reading your book, we put in the picture real clear, is what has changed with, you know, the likes of the Indian IPL is, you know, for a little while there, you were earning $1 million a season, right? I mean, the money, has that changed? I mean, what's that like, firstly? And I think the only honest answer is probably good, but you tell me. And then what's that done to the game?
Oh, I mean, you know, I wanted to play for New Zealand, but once I played for New Zealand, my next goal was to have a freehold house.
Yeah.
That was, you know, you talk to everyone and you set yourself up, buy a house. Then IPL turns up. life-changing. It is different, though, when everyone knows what you're on.
Yeah, that's annoying.
You're expected to buy everything. And it's like, okay. Nah, but and some of it's joking. You can understand it. But, oh, I mean, in terms of setting up your family, IPL has been amazing. I think not only the money side of it, I mentioned it in the book, I genuinely believe that IPL has been fantastic for New Zealand cricket. Not necessarily because the boys obviously earn a lot more, but it broke down the barriers. It broke down the aura. You know, my first team had Callis, Boucher, Chanderpaul, and all the guys were spread them out amongst the other teams. And we used to watch Australia warm up, and I think we were almost beaten before we played them. You know, we'd watch what their new drills they would do and be in it. And, you know, obviously they were the best team in the world and there was an aura around them. But I think IPL broke down those barriers. It made it – they were better than us, but it just reinforced that. We're doing the right things and we weren't too far away. And then now the team, you know, you get a world-class side that, you know, if they don't make a semi-final or final or win a competition, that, which is good, that the public you know, proud of and obviously scrutinise if they don't make it.
In your journey from Masterton to Palmy to, you know, around the world, and, you know, I take it, you know, you're still not a, you know, I call beer and racing man and so on, but one thing you have acquired a taste for that comes through very clearly, and I think it started with Hogan and his Pinot Noir, is the red wine. So favourite go-to red wine? Actually, let's add to that. Let's say money's no object here, because I picked up you've got a taste for the finer things in this area.
Hopefully my wife doesn't listen to this. Oh, no, she knew I brought this. I brought a bottle. It's called it's a Romney Conti DRC. It's a DRC Latache. And I saw it the other day, and it's up to about $13,000 a bottle. So...
When you're opening that, then, Jay, let me give you some advice. No, don't do it at the Taj Mahal with Leanne, okay?
Yeah, I don't. And I need to hide it because I have heard stories about some expensive bottles of wine that wives have no idea pop open and put into a casserole or a spaghetti bolognese or something. That could be one serious mistake. But no, I don't think I could justify. I've always just wanted to have one. And these wines can store for 50 to 70 years. So if I still own it, the kids can decide what they want to do with it.
Not at that level, but, you know, I've had some, you know, better bottles in my time. And what you say is exactly right. You know, I made the mistake of being at Parliament a while back, and my bleeding father-in-law was over from the UK, and he was taking some of my best stuff down to the cheeky Indian BYO, right? I got back and he drank like a, you know, $400 bottle of wine. And I said, what is this? Because I had made the mistake of saying, you know, whatever you like, right? But it was like within reason. There's some $20 ones and there's the sort of half a grand ones, and the $20 ones are the ones for you.
Yeah, there's a pile in the corner. Everyone's got free rein apart from that rack. Absolutely.
Are you a snob when it comes to the wine?
Oh, I'm getting worse. I'm not going to lie. As long as I'm not that person that people feel pressure when they come around for dinner. But if you do come around, Simon, there's plenty of wine around here if you help yourself. Just that rack, you're not allowed to touch.
I'm looking forward to it. We'll be going straight to that rack. Because the problem is, right, if we have two or three of the cheaper ones, at that point in time, I reckon you'll then take me to the expensive one. We should have started the expensive rack, right? Because by the time you've had two or three,
they all taste the same.
The expensive one, exactly.
100%.
Well, so that's what I say, if you're going to do it.
You've got to do it in the right order. Start with the good stuff because, you know, you're two or three deep. I can tell you whatever you want to hear. That's in that wine, really.
Hey, Ross, it's been fantastic to have you. We're just going to wrap up by asking some questions I ask every guest. It's a section we call general knowledge. What single object would you save from your house?
Single object? My black cap.
That's good. I like that. But I was thinking it could be that 13K bottle of red wine, right? That's what I'd be saving, but no, fair enough. What's the best night out you've ever had?
Best night out. There's been a few, but I think you win a World Cup. I think you drink it with your teammates, the mace you couldn't really drink out of. But it was still, we lost the World Cup final in 2019, but that was still a pretty amazing night in terms of you're at Lord's, the home of cricket. So I'll say that instead of hanging out with Shaggy.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, on the other nights where you lose big, I imagine they're pretty bloody miserable, but can they sometimes be quite good? You salvage a terrible thing with a great night out after?
If it's just a normal game, probably no. But you made a World Cup final. You've done pretty well to have got that far, and obviously you didn't do as well as you would have liked. And then I guess the next day you really see what it's like.
What's the best advice given to you and who gave it?
Best advice? Oh, I'd say my dad. Don't do drugs, don't ride a motorbike, and take your time while batting. Those were the three things he told me as a kid. And I tried to do that in terms of taking my time when batting, but there was just a couple of times where I just had to go. But everything else, that was just the three things that he reinforced to me.
Hey, Ross Taylor, we really appreciate having you on Generally Famous. You've been listening to Generally Famous. There's a new episode every Wednesday. You can listen to them all at stuff.co.nz/generallyfamous or wherever you get your podcasts. In fact, if you follow us on Apple or Spotify, any of the podcast apps, in fact, you'll get the latest episode automatically. Go on, it's really quick and easy. I'd love to hear from you. Send your feedback to generallyfamousstuff.co.nz. And if there's a guest you'd really like me to talk to, contact the same address. Thanks to my producers, Chris Reed and Jen Black. I'm Simon Bridges. I really appreciate you listening.
If you liked listening to this pod, help us make more like this. Visit stuff.co.nz/support.
Prepare for an unfiltered journey through the harsh realities of infertility.
My name's Nadine Higgins. I'm a broadcaster, a journalist, and I've been trying to make a baby with my husband.
That's me. I'm Dan. And we reckon infertility is lonely enough without making it a dirty little secret.
In The Human Race with Dan and Nadine Higgins, we share raw and unvarnished stories of couples who have faced the brutal truth of infertility.
At least you've been in it. It's really tough and really lonely.
Yeah, and also, this is really weird, but baby showers, you don't need to open the presents in front of everyone.
Confronting the harsh reality that not every story has a happy ending.
This very blunt, abrasive doctor who I had, you know, had not seen before, who delivered the news just like, you'll probably never have a natural period again and you'll probably never have a baby.
The Human Race, where we share the untold stories of couples in the race of their lives to create a life.
I feel like I nearly missed out and I got to do it, and so I feel really lucky. So it's been incredibly positive.
Listen today at stuff.co.nz/thehumanrace or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Human Race is proudly brought to you by Elevate.